all the good investments I made in life. But I want to kind of forget about the bad ones that I made, and I've made some of those too. But everybody likes to win. And we're getting ready to look at a great victory today. And I can say that every sincere Christian here, I think I can say this confidently, every sincere Christian here this morning wants to win in the Christian life. You want to do better. You want to be a better Christian. You want to serve the Lord better. You want to be a winner. Well, we're going to see some keys to victory in this chapter. If we just look at this chapter about the children of Israel conquering Jericho, yeah, we can get excited. The Lord's wonderful. But we need to apply it to our Christian life. And there were certain keys that Israel followed that led to victory. And without these keys, God could have still given it to them. But I'm not sure it would have happened. And we certainly need to look at this. If you want to win, I'm going to give you some keys. Now, you'll probably see some more than the ones that I give you. But that's all right. These are definitely keys to victory, the ones we'll talk about this morning. So I'd like to call your attention to them. And the first thing we're going to do before we go into this story of the great victory of Israel, I want us to read the first seven verses. And we're only going to read the first seven verses because the rest of the story follows exactly what these first seven verses talk about. Now, we'll refer to some more verses that add something to it as we go into it. But the main thrust of the story is in the first seven verses. Joshua chapter 6, verse 1. Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king out of the mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all of your men of war. You shall go around the city once. You shall do this 6 days. And seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the seventh day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. Then it shall come to pass when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout. Then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up every man straight before him." Then Joshua the son of Nun called the priest and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord." And he said to the people, "Proceed and march around the city and let him who is armed advance before the Ark of the Lord." Now the rest of the chapter we read about them doing exactly what the Lord asked them to do. What are the keys to victory here in this passage? The first one we find in verses 12 through 16, which we haven't read, but the first key to victory is obedience. Because what we see happening in verse 12 through 16, we see them obeying exactly what they were told to do. Joshua rose up early in the morning, and the priest took up the ark of the Lord, and the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horn, and so forth. Exactly what the Lord had instructed them to do, this is what they did. If you want to be victorious in life, if you want to be victorious in the Christian life, the first step is obedience. Saul didn't get this message. Remember, the Lord spoke to him and said to obey is better than sacrifice. Obey. Obedience is key. Now, obedience is based on several things that come to mind. The first one is respect. Joshua had deep respect for the Lord. For 40 years, he had seen the Lord lead Israel through the wilderness. All kinds of problems, food problems, water problems, all of this. Joshua had observed God coming in and taking care of it. God had earned a deep respect in the heart of Joshua. Now, it's hard to obey someone that we don't respect. Now, suppose you've got a boss that's inept. Some of you have had some of those sometime. And he tells you to do the wrong thing. And the Bible tells you you're supposed to obey him. You do because the Bible tells you to, but it's hard. It's so much easier if you've got a leader that time after time after time has told you to do something, and the vast majority of times it's come out well. It's come out well for the project. It's come out well for you. It's come out well for him. It's come out well for whoever you're working for, whoever you're working with. So respect is very key in soliciting obedience. But there's also something else that's very key, and that's relationship. Think about the husband and the wife. There's a deep relationship. And obedience is easy when you have a deep relationship. I can tell you right now, if Gail asks me to do something and one of you all asks me to do something that conflicts with it, I'll tell you who I'm going to obey because of our relationship, the husband and wife relationship. It's a deep relationship. The worker-employee relationship, I mean, the worker-employer relationship is one that we should... biblically, we should obey. And if that relationship, I've worked for people I would do most anything for. Because I had deep respect for them. Because they treated me right in the past. And when they said to do something, I was eager to do it. Because I knew they had my best interest at heart. And then there's also the relationship of two friends. Or several friends. If a friend asks you to do something, that takes priority, in my mind, over somebody that you don't know, unless you have some special relationship from the Lord, a special revelation from the Lord. If a friend asks me to do something, that would take priority over someone that I don't know, unless there's some overriding circumstances. The child and the parents. We've got that relationship. The children are to obey their parents. And if that relationship is good, then it's easy for the children to obey their parents. And then there's the government and the citizen. Sometimes the government doesn't do what we want them to do, but we're to obey, and we do. Because it's logical and it's biblical. These things dictate, these relationships dictate biblically and logically that we obey. And so we do. And that's pleasing to the Lord. But the more intimate the relationship, the easier it is to obey. Now, there's another basis for obedience, and that's fear. And fear can mean dread or reverence. And I'm going to take it up in both aspects because I think both have some applicability here. Dread. The fear of misconduct. What's going to happen with misconduct? I'll tell you, he didn't do it nearly often enough as I grew up. But my dad had an old belt that was on the back porch. And it had ripped and the buckle had come off, but the leather was still good. And he had it hanging up on the back porch. And it should have happened many more times than it did, but he was a loving dad and he didn't do it. But I can remember my mom telling me several times, and I'm going to tell your dad when he gets home. And when he would come in and hear the story, he'd say, go get the belt. I learned at a young age what fear was, what dread was. Go get the belt. And so I obeyed my mother. I obeyed my dad because of fear, because of dread, because I realized what was going to happen if I didn't obey. And so that's a basis for obedience. My dad and I had a saying that the first time was serious and it got to be a joke. But he would tell me, he said, I want the grass cut. I want the lawn mowed. And I'd say, okay, Dad, I'll do it. I said, what are you going to give me if I cut the grass? He said, son, your problem ain't what I'm going to give you if you cut it. Your problem is what I'm going to give you if you don't cut it. And so I cut it. I did it out of dread. But then there's the other aspect of it, and it's the idea of reverence. I knew that my dad loved me. So I could trust him with real reverence. And I have the highest respect today in my mind for my dad. Was he a perfect dad? No. Was he a good dad? Yes. And I have the highest respect for him today. And I didn't obey him many times when I should have, particularly in my teen years. But I still had that reverence for him, that respect for him. And it was really genuine. So, the first key is obedience. But then there was a second key that we see in verses 6 through 8. And it's right part of what we read. The Lord has spoken to, in verse 6, in the first five verses, the Lord has spoken to Joshua and told him what to do. And then Joshua, the son of Nun, in verse 6, called the priest and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant and let the seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. And he said to the people, proceed and march around the city and let him who is armed advance before the Ark of the Lord. So it was when Joshua had spoken to the people that the seven priests bearing seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord advanced and blew the trumpets, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. The Lord tells them to do something. And I don't know whether you thought about it, but it takes a lot of faith to do what the Lord asked them to do. They're emotional people and they're logical people. I tend to lean to the logical side. And when somebody tells me 2 and 2 is 5, they're suspect. It's got to be logical for me to accept it or buy it unless I'm operating by faith. So anyway, that's what we see in verses 6 through 8. Joshua believed, and then the people believed. Now, let's talk about faith a minute. Faith is believing what you can't see. You walk out on a day and you see, man, leaves flying and trees bending over, and all of a sudden you say, look at the wind. That's a bad statement, folks. You've never seen the wind. You see the results of the wind. I'll never forget when we were moving from Atlanta to Phoenix, Arizona. We got in Texas and got in a dust storm. We had to stop the car. It's the worst thing I'd ever seen. I'd never seen anything like it. But you're out there into nothing but space. I mean, you don't see any trees or anything. And suddenly the wind got up. And we thought we saw the wind. Well, we didn't. We saw the results of the wind. It was black. You couldn't see a thing. We had to pull the car over and sit in that mess for about an hour till it cleared up. But the point is, believing something you haven't seen. I believe in the wind, but I've never seen it. Didn't you walk in and you cut on a switch on the wall and you say, look at the electricity. You haven't seen electricity. You've seen the results of electricity, which causes a light bulb to come on. And I can't explain all of that, and I don't understand it. I've never seen it. But I believe in electricity. I believe very firmly in it. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. As you have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk you in him. So we've got to have faith. And Israel had faith. I believe in a God that I've never seen. He's never spoken to me audibly. Some people feel that he has, but he's never spoken to me audibly. He's spoken to me out of his word, but I've never heard a voice of God. And yet I believe it. I've staked my soul's salvation on this God. I believe in him with every fiber of my being. But I've never seen him. That's faith. In Hebrews 11:30, we see the great faith chapter. We see faith giving way to sight because we read, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled 7 days. So we see faith giving place to sight. But faith is also believing what you don't understand. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't understand hypnosis. That is a mystery to me. I do not understand that. I don't understand schizophrenia. I can't figure that one out. I've seen some people I think may have it, but I can't figure it out. There are a lot of things. I can't figure out creation. I can't figure out God's love. I can't figure out the Trinity. I can't figure out parts of eschatology. There are things that I don't understand. The things that all of us don't understand. But how about having a God that you can understand? The whole Bible is about God. If it was a God, so in some respects, the whole Bible we can't understand. And I'm not saying that I understand there are portions of it, but the part about God we don't understand. I don't understand the Trinity. Can't figure that out. That's beyond human comprehension. I don't understand a God who could love a world that constantly spits in his face. I don't understand that. And yet that's the story of the Bible. That's the story of redemption that we were hearing about. That God starts out and he starts this great plan of redemption. Why in the world would he do that? And yet we believe it. We believe something that we don't understand. God involves the incomprehensible, and yet we believe in him. Something that we can't understand. But faith is also believing the impossible. Israel had reason to believe the Lord. The crossing of the Red Sea, that was impossible. The crossing of the Jordan River, which we studied several weeks ago, that's impossible. The conquest of Jericho without a shot being fired, that's impossible. Yet Israel believed that it was going to happen. Now I'm going to give you an illustration of real faith. This preacher in a small church had a group of teenagers, and teacher after teacher just gave up and said, you know, we can't do it. So this is the worst group we've ever seen. So the preacher said, I'll take care of them. He said, I'll teach them a class. So he comes in and he teaches them. And he's telling them all the stuff that they need to do and quit doing and all that stuff, which was legitimate, all he was saying. And then he finishes. And in between the services, like ours, this was during Sunday school class, he had to preach later, so he lays his Bible down. So the teenagers got the Bible, and he had his notes in a particular place, and so they knew where he was going to preach from, but they suspected it. So they took two of the sheets very carefully, and they glued them together. And so the preacher gets up to preach, and he starts to read. He said, when Noah was 120 years old, he took a wife who was, and then he turned the page, who was 40 cubits wide, built of gopher wood, covered with pitch inside and out. The preacher recovered pretty well. He said, folks, I'll have to admit that I've never read the scripture before, but I accept it as evidence that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And that's real faith. And it's an enjoyable story, but that's real faith, to read something that's that unbelievable and believe it. And that's what we have to do. If we're to please God, we must have faith. But there's another aspect of it here. And we find this in verses 17 and 25. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, and if all who are in it, and all who are in it, only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are in her house, because she's hid the messengers that were sent. And then verse 25, and Joshua sped Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Loyalty. That's something we don't hear a lot about today, but something that I have great, great respect for. Being loyal. Being loyal is keeping your word. Rahab had a promise from Israel, and Israel kept the promise. And so should you, and so should I. This thing of saying you didn't miss it, you didn't understand me, or something like that. If you say you're going to do something, do it. We learn too much in watching politicians. I really didn't mean that. I don't know this. I don't know that. We see too much of that. No, we need to be loyal. You need to be loyal to the church fellowship you're part of. You need to be loyal to the Christians in that fellowship. You need to be loyal to the Christians that you know. You need to be loyal to the unsaved friends that you have and the saved friends that you have. There's loyalty. And Israel was loyal. And that was a key to their success. That was a key to victory. They were loyal. But also, it's remembering others who have helped you. When things are going well, it is easy to forget those who played a vital role in our success. It's easy to do. We tend to forget about the people that have given us success, the success that we have. You remember the story of Joseph and the butler in prison. And the butler had a dream, and Joseph interprets his dream for him and tells him that, hey, you're going to be forgiven and restored to your former place. And sure enough, very shortly this happens. And the butler's there in the house of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh has this dream, and Pharaoh can't find any of his sorcerers that can interpret it. And the butler remembered Joseph. Told him about it. It led to Joseph being freed from prison because Joseph interpreted the dream. It led to Joseph being made number two behind Pharaoh in Egypt. Remembering those who've helped you in the past is very, very important. And then loyalty is also showing love and respect to a friend. Folks, you stick with a friend. Do you always agree with them? No. Are they always the epitome of everything you want them to be? No. But you stick with a friend. Do you have arguments? Disagreements? Yes. But you know, most arguments and disagreements can be settled with one simple sentence. I'm sorry. That solves most of them. 99% of them, that'll fix it. A sincere "I'm sorry" will fix any breach in a friendship that has occurred. Loyalty. But there's one more, and I want us to spend the rest of our time just allotted to us on this one. It's patience. In those verses we read, if my math's right, the Lord asked Israel to march around the city of Jericho 13 times. Now, I don't know about you, but after I got around the first time, I would have said, man, this is okay. We're going to win. The second time, on the second day, I said, you know, this is repetitious. My job when I used to work for a living was to try to make things more efficient. This is the most inefficient operation I've ever seen. The third day, doing the same thing again? Fourth day, same thing, fifth day? Man, I've had it. What is this? Now, I know most of you all are impatient, and that wouldn't bother you at all. It bothers me. It would have bothered me. I would have been bothered by it. Israel did God's work in God's way, no matter how foolish the marching seemed. Scriptures tell us to do things that don't make good sense sometimes, humanly speaking. When God tells us to do something, patience is... God doesn't get in a hurry. God's an eternal God. That's what we can't understand about it. All of us have got time. We got this clock. I got a clock I'm looking at back there on the wall. We've got clocks. God got his clock, but it's not a 24-hour clock. It's a different clock, and he's not in a hurry. We're the ones that are in a hurry. Patience is waiting when everything within you says go. Here we come to a track meet. The gun sounds. Everybody sprints off. And I'm looking at them. And I'm saying, you know, what am I doing waiting? What is this waiting? The gun sounded. God says, wait. Go around one more time. Then when you finally get to the seventh day, I want you to go around seven times. Waiting, but not just waiting. Waiting on purpose. I will wait on God. It's a lesson most of us need to learn, probably. I know it's a lesson that I need to learn. Patience is faith in the existence, compassion, and promises of God. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Patience leads to success. It's the key to success. Gibbon spent 20 years writing the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. Noah Webster spent 36 years writing his dictionary. George Bancroft spent 26 years writing the history of the United States. Christ has already spent 2,000 years building his church. And he's still building it. He's still winning another one and another one and another one. Building his church. God is not in a hurry. He's not impatient. Patience is sitting when everything within you says do. Patience is not a desperate waiting in doubt, but a hopeful waiting in confidence. Patience with others is love. Patience with self is hope. Patience with God is faith. Patience. This flies in the face of this do something if it's wrong mentality. This flies in the face of I want it now generation that we live in. It's something that we have to strive for, something we have to work at. Something that's very, very important. And then patience is also trusting when everything within you says take action. Hey, let's do something. Trust me. No, trust me. Some type B personalities might not have that much trouble with patience, but type A's. It bothers them. It needs to be done. It needs to be fixed. The building's on fire. Call the fire department. Get out the hose. Trusting when everything within you says take action. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not unto your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. Last book in the Bible, we read this verse. In the first chapter of Revelation, I, John, both your brother and companion in the tribulation and kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ, was on the island that is called Patmos for the word of God, for the testimony of Jesus Christ. Here's John, one of the inside three of the disciples. The one that had a very intimate relationship as far as love and concern for each other with the Lord. And suddenly he's exiled off to an island. He's lost all his fellowship with the other disciples. He's lost all the fellowship with his friends, his family. He lost everything. What a waste. Here's this great man, one of the top three of the disciples. The one that the Lord spent the most time, as we understand it, trying to cultivate and develop. And yet here he is. On a lone island, exiled. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice as a trumpet saying, I am Alpha and Omega. The Mount of Transfiguration was only a taste of what was going to be revealed to John in the next 21 chapters. We don't understand all that was revealed to him. But we understand one thing. We understand how the story ends. And that man that was forsaken and crucified on the cross is now lifted up. King of the universe, and we're going to be with him. Every knee is going to bow to him. That's the way the story ends. Because a man had patience, God was able to come into his life and speak to him in a wonderful way. Folks, I don't know what you need to work on today. I can spend some time on all four of them that we've talked about. But pick out one. Try to do better, and it'll be a key to your victory in your Christian life. And you can enjoy God more and serve him better. And he'll be happier with the way you're living if you'll pick one of these four things and seek to make it better in your life. In the meantime, as we go to the Lord's Supper, we can just rejoice in the fact that, hey, we've read the last part of the book, and it's going to be good. Everything is going to be okay, folks. Praise God.